This is the latest disclosure in a report from National Civil Defense Headquarters in Washington. It has been established that persons who have recently died have been returning to life and committing acts of murder. A widespread investigation of reports from funeral homes, morgues, and hospitals has concluded that the unburied dead are coming back to life and seeking human victims.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to another edition of After Hours AM with myself, Joel Sturgis. Of course, as always, the beautiful, talented, awesome Jennifer Mattson.
Oh, I bet you say that to all the girls.
Well, come on now. Let's not get that carried away. I don't say to all of them, only the ones that pay attention to me.
Oh. Well, that would be me.
That's correct. Now, oh. did you hear at the top of the show we played the infamous Night of the Living Dead news report?
I did. That was pretty smooth.
You know what we're talking about tonight?
You know what? I'm going to go on a limb and say zombies.
That's right. Zombies.
Zombies, people.
We got one of the coolest guests ever tonight. Yeah. And he wrote this phenomenal book called The Zombie Autopsies.
I know.
But he goes beyond just the zombies running around eating people. He really kind of dives into the psychology of it all.
Really?
And that is really what intrigued me, was how he came across with that. And, you know, Steve is, you know, his last name is a tough one, so I'm going to let him do that one. But Steve is Schlossman. How'd I do, Steve?
You got it.
Cool.
You got it.
Cool.
Way to go.
Steve Schlossman, MD, is assistant professor of psychiatry, at Harvard Medical School. So he knows his stuff when it comes to this human psyche. And he is just, you know, he's a great, great guy. We've been talking off air a little bit here and there. And he has a really good sense of himself and what the subject matter is all about. Unlike a lot of the people we talk about or to about the subject, they don't grab it like he does.
Well, how can you really grab that kind of subject?
Exactly.
I mean, you're talking zombies.
Yeah. Well,
because you got the fast ones and you got the slow ones.
This is true.
You know,
this is true.
You got the videos that have the zombies grabbing guns.
Well, and don't forget the zombie fighting a shark underwater.
Okay, I haven't had the pleasure to see that.
Well, without further ado, let's get our guest in here. Steve, are you there?
I'm here.
Hey,
thanks,
Steve.
Hey, welcome,
oh,
Steve.
Absolutely. Welcome to After Hours AM. We're so happy to have you.
Thank you.
So what made you, just start right away, what made you want to write a book like The Zombie Autopsy?
It's sort of a long story. It's a good question. What made me want to risk my academic career? I love horror movies. I've always loved them, and I especially love zombie movies. I actually came to loving zombie movies a little bit later in my love of the horror genre. They just offer all sorts of opportunities for social commentary, and they also jive really well with scientific explanations. So back in, I think, 2009, I was up late. Couldn't sleep one night, and Night of the Living Dead was on because, as you guys probably know, it's an eminent domain movie. It wasn't ever copyrighted, so it's always on sometime, someplace. And I actually know George Romero pretty well right now, so you and I have talked a lot about the history of that. I was watching it, and I was thinking, you know, if they were real zombies and they were shambling down our streets, we wouldn't kill them. I hope they would be humans and they would be sick, and we would bring them into Windsor rooms and we try to make them better.
So now I wrote a fake paper about it.
Well, exactly.
But if a zombie's coming and trying to eat you, you know, I mean, I don't know. I don't think I'd be like, hey, let's go to the hospital and figure out what's going on with you. I'd probably do the self-defense thing and try to smack him in the head.
It's a really good point. Now, so I have to lead with the caveat that the dean of Harvard Medical School likes me to issue, which is that they're not real.
Mm-hmm. No, they are not.
They're not. I need to be very clear about that, having been on the radio before and not having made that clear as soon as I asked of. But the conceit of the zombie movie, the thing that makes it so interesting is, yeah, they're trying to eat you, but you don't actually know that until they're right on top of you.
Yeah, so, that's so true.
Touché.
You know, so you can't, you run the risk of actually attacking a potential ally.
Mm-hmm.
It could just be someone who's drunk or someone who's sick or someone has the flu. And in fact, you may need this human to help you deal with the other, you know, more badly infected humans with the zombie bug. So really, the worst enemy that we have in zombie movies are each other. That's all I can do. All you have to do is walk slightly
that.
Faster than the zombie and you get away. You mentioned slow and fast moving zombies. That is a hotly debated issue at all of the Comic Cons I've spoken at. But I am partial to the slow moving zombies. I think they're more cool and they're also scarier.
Yep, I'm more of a fan of the Romero zombie, the original.
Yeah.
You know, kind of meander.
Yeah. Well, because you don't know. You don't know. You see this thing coming out of the fog on the other side of the football field, and it sure looks like your girlfriend, and it's just stumbling towards you, and you're just hoping it's your girlfriend, and then. You know, but you hope just a little bit too long, and all you had to do is just take two steps backwards, but you don't, and then she bites you, and then we're off to the races.
There you are. Then another zombie's born.
Right.
If your girlfriend's walking up to you and she's giving you that look, you might want to run.
I don't know. It depends how long it's been. You know.
Hey, when I get that look from Jennifer, I run.
And he's a smart man.
Well, I got to go. See you all later. You know, the thing of it is the zombie movie, I was always more intrigued, not by the zombie itself, although they are cool, but how the people reacted to the zombie. On how they came together to either fight against a zombie or fight against each other.
Yep. And in fact, the thing that happens in every zombie movie that I like, the ones that I'm partial to, is the sort of motley crew of humans who would never in a million years been even sit next to each other in a bus are sort of drawn together, thrown together. Mm-hmm. They end up walling up in some kind of symbolic structure like a church or a shopping mall and down the dead, or, you know, something, a house out in the woods and you die living dead. And then they get overcome by their own petty, kind of racist, backwards thinking about each other rather than dealing with the relatively simple problem at hand. I mean, zombies can't even open windows. They're not that hard to beat.
No.
And yet the humans turn on each other.
That is very, very true.
That is really true.
Very
and
true.
I was on your website today and I saw a story, how to zombie proof your car. I really dig that. That's really cool.
Oh, could you elaborate on that for us curious people? How do you zombie proof a car?
So what did you see? I haven't looked at that piece. I can remember some of it, that Joe indulged me and tell me what you saw.
Okay. When you're zombie-proofing your car, it's all about barrier is what it's about. So if you're going to be driving down the streets of Minneapolis or where have you, you want a big, heavy vehicle that they can't push over, number one. You want to have defenses on the vehicle, number two, like big, sharp stuff. That way, if you need it, it's there, you know, like a cow catcher in the front, all that kind of good stuff. And then you need ports to shoot guns. Now, that's the cool part.
and extra gasoline.
Well, yeah. I mean, what do you do when you run out of gas in a zombie apocalypse? You're kind of done for. You know, would be my...
Yeah. Because if you run
out of gas. Hey, there you are, Steve. We had a momentary glitch there. It looks like we're... That's all good. We were just...
I'm back.
Oh, that's cool. Cool. I know. I didn't even know we lost you there until the engineer says, hey, hold on. That's okay.
Sorry about that.
No, not a problem. Not a problem whatsoever. Getting back to us, talk about zombie proofing a car. It's a neat little story you have on your website, and it's more or less just weight, lots of sharp things, and places to shoot a gun. That's pretty much all there is to zombie proofing a car.
Yes, yeah, so you remember that scene in the original Dawn of the Dead in 1978? I think it's like a UPS truck, and they basically do that. They got spikes, they got little holes to put the guns through, and then they go busting out there. And you know, part of the other side of the fun of zombie movies are exactly those scenes. I mean, once we get over the fact that they're not savable to the people who are infected, which is a hard one for me to get over for all sorts of reasons.
Well, sure.
It's sort of fun to drive into all of them and blow them away. And then we start to feel guilty about it. I think the viewers start to feel guilty, especially because almost every time the people in the zombie-proof cars go shooting down the highway, they run into remaining humans that they didn't expect to find, and they feel a little bit sheepish that they were so prepared to kind of throw in the towel. And you even saw that in Zombieland when they shoot Bill Murray.
Yeah, I know. Poor Bill Murray. He was just trying to fit in.
He just wants to fit in. He's a people person.
Yeah, that's right. He just wants to go play a game of golf. Let the man be.
Right. Right.
But the thing of it is, the zombies, though, as far as a creature goes, I've always wondered, and when the movie World War Z came out, I was kind of disappointed because it really had nothing to do with the book, the movie, and I was kind of looking forward to them traveling up north to get away from the zombies.
Yep.
Because to be quite honest with you, if a zombie apocalypse happened, I'd just stay in my house up here in Minnesota. They'd just freeze.
Right. And even if they don't freeze, they just move on even slower than they normally do.
Well, that's it. Eventually, you know, they're going to freeze.
Well, and you can do a light jog because, you know, they're dead.
Yep.
And their bones are basically all limber. So you can do a light jog and you can get away from these.
Yep.
You know, so
But like Steve was saying. Oh, go ahead, Steve.
No, I was going to say, just the fascinating thing about that whole construct is the wonderful and scary thing about zombies is they actually don't care about us at all.
Like, no.
It's the exact opposite of vampires, right, which totally care about, or at least make us think they care about us, and that's how they try. And vampires, by the way, also don't exist. And even if they did, they certainly don't sparkle, but that's a different issue altogether.
No, they don't. I really didn't like the movie Twilight movies, but that's just me. But But I think that if a zombie apocalypse personally happened tomorrow, and a lot of, like you said, diverse people had to get together, I would be more afraid of the people I was with than the zombie himself.
Oh, that's the crux of the movie. I mean, I've had a lot of opportunities to talk with a lot of people who write in this genre, including a lot of opportunities to talk with George, who's become a real mentor and friend. And that's what he was getting at. He didn't even call him zombie. Night of the Living Dead was called Night of the Flesh Eaters.
Mm-hmm.
And it was changed at the last minute. He didn't intend to make a movie about the ghouls so much as he intended to make a movie about how we screw it up all the time.
It was a lot of social commentary of the day.
Oh, it's so ripe for that. You know, so going from Night of the Living Dead with the obvious kind of racial overtones, when you've got a black protagonist, one of the first, by the way, in all of American movies. And then you get to Dawn of the Dead, where you've got this, like, really wonderful commentary on consumerism. Mm-hmm. In the first of the big shopping malls. I mean, they were just showing up in 1978 and 79. It was just so neat the way that, because zombies were such blank slates, you could sort of place them into any social context and make pretty kind of... not what you were expecting to be profound comments about the world in a way that we could better tolerate them.
No,
that's what I love about it.
George sure made it work, though.
Oh, I love him. I love him. He did. And he and I have talked a lot about that. He, after he did Night of the Living Dead, took 10 years to make another zombie movie because he thought, oh my God, what have I stumbled onto here?
Yeah.
And want to really make it happen. And so a lot of that stuff had less to do with CGI special effects and more to do with just creating mood and atmosphere.
Yeah, exactly. Day of the Dead came out, which was a good movie in its own right. The storyline was, these humans are trapped underground, and the zombies are upstairs. They're downstairs. And, it was a good movie. I know when I did speak with George, because I've interviewed George on the radio, he wishes he would have had more zombies. He wishes he would have, he looks back and he says, I wish I could have done this. I wish I could have done that. But, hindsight's 20/20. I thought he did pretty darn good with Land of the Dead when he released that. It seemed like it kind of owned for all that.
I love Land of the Dead. I love Dennis Hopper. I love Big Dick.
it was a good movie.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Really,
I should say is, George Roffin gets he optioned. I don't know if you guys know this. He optioned my book, and we finished the script, so it's out there bouncing around Hollywood, and hopefully someone will pick it up. It was really fun to put together and to make it into a movie. But in that setting, we've had a chance to talk about his other movies, and he's made some great non-zombie movies. Like, if you ever saw Martin,
one of
the best vampire movies.
Yeah, and Bruiser was one all Martin, there.
Bruiser's lovely. Bruiser's a wonderful movie. And also one of Ed Harris's first movie, Knight Riders, is a great film. But the Knights of King Arthur, that they ride motorcycles instead of horses. It's great.
Yeah, George, unfortunately, I don't want to say unfortunately, but in some ways got stuck in the zombie pigeonhole because no one ever mentions those other works.
Right. That's why I always try to bend over backwards just to get in there. That is not to say I don't love zombies, or goodness, that's a double negative. I love zombies, and I always will. But I like the movies that keep the sort of equal parts gore and humor. I think that's actually what makes the genre fun. But Peter Jackson's first movie was on the Dead Alive, movie from New Zealand. That's a great movie. It's really fun and really funny and also really, really wise and really gory, which makes it all good fun.
Well, tell us a little bit more about the zombie autopsies. Take us through the book a little bit.
Sure. So in what I tried to do was think of a biological explanation that was the most plausible for what was clearly a fictional phenomenon. So it's like these things don't exist, and they're not going to exist, and the chance of them existing ever is almost nothing. When I go to Comic-Con and people say, when will the zombie apocalypse happen, and I say, it ain't going to happen, they all boo, which I always think is funny, because I'm like, look, this is not something you want. This is a bad thing.
Yeah.
But if it were to happen, what would have to happen? And if you're a doctor and you think about the brain, you teach neuroscience, all of which I do, it's hard not to think about how the brain would be affected. So I imagined this world in the sort of contemporary future, like 2013, 2000, when I wrote the book was 2009. Mm-hmm. So I set it in 2013. And the whole world has been infected by this horrific virus that's sort of equal parts prions, this terrifying, the stuff that causes bad cow disease and Creutzfeldt-Jakob's. And then it's spread airborne through the influenza virus. And then there's an added kind of mystery virus that's recombinantly designed. It's clearly a man-made virus. And that infects the ventromedial hypothalamus, which is the region of the brain that makes you hungry. And it turns out there are real viruses that do this, the adenovirus and the foreignovirus, two biggies. They'll infect that region and make you eat, not recognize that you're full. Because one of the biggest dilemmas when you're trying to explain the zombies, is, especially if you're explaining them from the perspective of being infected with something, is that they're hungry. Because if you think about the last time you had a cold or had the flu, you weren't hungry. You didn't feel like eating anything. So to have something be febrile and ravenously hungry is actually hard to do. You rarely see that in medicine, but you do see it. So I created that scenario, and then the book is all set on this island in the South Pacific, kind of colloquially called the crypt, where scientists are flown in to dissect zombies. But those scientists themselves are slowly changing. So as they get closer and closer to understanding what causes the zombie virus to progress, they themselves are losing their own minds, and then eventually they get thrown into the pen because they become zombies. The next group of scientists have to come in and dissect that.
Oh, man.
So they're not, it's sort of morbid.
Okay, you're like, twisted, like, but I really like it. I like it. I like the story. I mean, what I mean is I like how it gets twisted, the story. It gets twisted around on the scientists.
Yeah, that is the goal. It's fun. I mean, it was written as a journal, which made it sort of fun to sort of discover journals at the time where it looks like we found a cure, but we're not sure. And rather than the virus being weaponized, we're led to believe that it's created by evil hedge fund managers who wanted the market to fall. Because it was 2009 when I wrote it.
It was ripe for the period right there. Because we're in the throes of this housing bubble. So,
right, exactly.
You threw some social commentary in there, and I like that.
Even in the news today, in 2009 especially, but still we have terms now like zombie banks or zombie loans, and what those essentially mean are things that are pretending to be what they're not or appear to be what they're not. It's not really a bank, it's not really a loan, it's not really a person.
Yeah.
And it brings up these really profound issues that no one kind of expects to get to, which is where do we draw our lines about how we define what's human and what's not. And that's what those scientists on the island in the book I wrote are struggling with, too. How I decide when I'm no longer human and really have to turn myself in to the pit, to the area where I get, you know, held until the next group of scientists can arrive.
Wow. Now, where can everyone find this great book? I mean...
You can find it at your local bookstore, I hope. It's been on the shelf for a while. And then it's on Amazon and various the online booksellers as well. It's in pretty much all the bookstores around now, and it tends to have ebbs and flows. Sold water on Halloween, dies down a little bit, sold a lot when The Walking Dead comes back on the air.
Yes.
Kind of goes back down a little bit, too. It's been fun, and it continues to get attention. And I'm grateful for that. It's really fun for me.
So I got to ask you, as a doctor, are there any diseases that would affect a human as quickly as they turn in the movies into a zombie?
Oh, that's a really great question. The one that comes to mind first for most folks is rabies. You'd have to have a quick-acting rabies. Rabies takes a long time to act. That's why you get bit by something. You got a few days to get in to see a doctor to get the shots. And if anybody ever, by the way, says they don't want to get a rabies shot, we just usually remind them that you only get rabies once because it's 100% fatal. You need to get the shot because you'll only have this once in your life if you happen to get it.
Yeah.
I got bit by a mole in my backyard this year when my dog caught one and went and got the shots. Rabies spreads through salivary droplets, and it does so by making its hosts excessively aggressive. So you wouldn't have the fast change the way you see in, you know, movies like World War Z, where Brad Pitt's counting to 10 or to 20 or whatever he's doing to watch the, you know, the incubation of the bug. But you would see that hyper-aggressiveness. What you don't see with rabies is appetite. In fact, you see the opposite of appetite. They actually shun swallowing anything because their esophageal area is so swollen. Mm-hmm. And hydrophobia. So if you show them water, even though they're in a state of delirium, don't pull shirk away from it. But rabies is what people think of most often. In terms of really quick-acting bugs, there's not a lot out there that'll do that. Some of the hemorrhagic viruses do that, but they cause you to bleed so quickly. We saw that in 28 Days Later, and they were playing with different strains of that when the crow's blood drops into the guy's eye, and then he's got, like, 10 seconds to change.
Yeah, it's almost a minute they change in these films, and I always thought to myself, wait a second. It would take you so long to succumb to a disease like that. You would be, it'd take a week or better.
That's for the sake of the story.
Mm-hmm.
that quick onset. In the story I wrote, I thought, just like with all diseases, there'll be a natural history. So there's four stages to the disease, and it takes, as you said, about a week. And you're progressing, so you're getting sicker as that week goes on, trying to control it by maintaining your internal pH. But eventually everybody succumbs.
Yeah. It's like rabies, 100% fatal.
It is 100% fatal, unless we cure it, unless we come up with a cure.
So it'd kind of be like, what's that movie? I Am Legend.
Uh-huh.
It takes a while for them to turn into whatever they were, and they were very, very aggressive. They didn't want to eat, you know, like I know where I'm going with this in my mind, I swear. But it took a while for them to become what they were, and they wanted to attack.
Yeah.
All the time.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. 100% aggressive all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's an interesting movie for a bunch of reasons. One is, you know, the original I Am Legend book. I think Robert Mathis wrote that, if I'm remembering right. So that actually had three incarnations as a movie. It had the Last Man on Earth, I think, with Vincent Price, and then the Omega Man with Charlton Heston, and then which is a great '70s flick, like sort of cool mod '70s flick, and then you know the most recent one with Will Smith. In all of those, the original. I Am Legend was about a vampire plague, not a zombie plague. But in all of them, the infected retain a certain amount of intelligence. They hunt as packs. They hunt with intention. They can set traps. So they have much higher brain function than you see in the sort of typical Romero zombies. But they're all iterations of this initial theme. Even though I Am Legend was written before Night of the Living Dead in 1968, the theme of the sort of wandering hordes, you know, mindlessly going after anything that moves, any human that moves, that actually didn't show up until 1968.
Yeah. Interesting. Exactly. Night of the Living Dead was what they call the granddaddy of them all as far as the modern zombie film. Because before then, it was all like, what was it, like voodoo zombies, stuff like that.
Yeah, no, there were a lot of movies about Haitian zombies and West African zombies, white zombie from 1938 with Bela Lugosi. Still a movie with social commentary involved because there it was the idea that, oh my goodness, a white person can become a zombie, not just a person with dark skin. But it wasn't until 1968 that we had this sort of modern conceptualization that, again, they weren't even supposed to be zombies. You might not know this, George was a cameraman for Mr. Rogers at the time when he made that movie.
I did not know that.
And he made it on the side. He made it with friends as a sort of anti-war movie.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I like your book and other books. Zombies are more or less the backdrop to the human condition in the story. The zombies, it could be sharks in the water. It could be anything. Quite honestly, the zombie could be, but it's how the humans interact with each other and how they solve the problem.
Yeah, no, zombies are, they represent, I mean, in fact, one of the reasons I think they've become so popular of late, and it might be waning a little bit, although it seems to have slow and still stay pretty peaked, I think is, you know, we all feel kind of disconnected and online and staring at screens. I know that's kind of a cliche, but it feels pretty real to me. Mm-hmm. You know, I got kids and I see them, you know, spend a lot of time on the screen, and I love media. So I don't really mind them being on the screen all that much, except I wonder if that's the only way we communicate with each other, then we sort of end up being kind of zombified. And I wonder if we're not feeling that way a little bit.
Yeah, have you ever gone to Walmart?
Perhaps it took off. Yeah, no, exactly.
Those are human zombies, man. I mean...
Yeah. So just stumbling up and down aisles, going through the motions, sitting mindlessly in traffic on the way home.
Yeah.
You know, the guy in front of you is not blocking you because he hates you. It's not about you. He just happens to be in front of you, and he's mad at the guy in front of him. That kind of human disconnection and lack of community, I think, lends itself to the zombie story in ways that, you know, more readily than we might like.
Exactly. But guys... We got to take a break, but we'll be right back. We're talking a little more zombies with our awesome guest, Steve Schulzman. Be right back right after this.
The adventure of a lifetime awaits you in faraway Egypt. The Exodus Reality Adventure, February 12th to 26th of 2014. Join archaeologist Dr. John Ward and historian Scotty Roberts, co-authors of The Exodus Reality, as they retrace their expedition searching for the historical Moses and the Great Exodus. There are 10 seats available. For details, go to exodusreality.com. The land of the pharaohs beckons. Will you answer the call to adventure?
It's your ideas, work, and creativity that make it your yard. At Ace, we're here to help with hoses and sprinklers to nurture growth, gardening tools for the shape of good things to come. even the right fertilizer and bug killers to make the grass a little greener. You'll find it all now at Ace, your place, with everything you need for your yard, plus helpful advice, almost like we're right there. Ace,
the helpful place.
Carl Sagan once wrote that the questioning mind needs to be instilled with both skepticism and wonder, for the universe is a pretty big place, filled with undelved mysteries, sciences, and life that we've barely begun to comprehend. Every month, Intrepid Magazine brings you both the wondrous and the skeptical. Intrepid Magazine focuses on science, metaphysics, UFOs, politics, conspiracies, and unexplained phenomena, all offered up by Intrepid's cadre of writers and contributors, comprised of a host of seasoned authors, pundits, and recognized names in their fields. The universe is indeed a big place, and where other magazines leave off, Intrepid Mag is just beginning. Subscribe to Intrepid Magazine today at www.intrepidmag.com. That's www.intrepidmag.com.
Hi, Gordon. What you been up to?
Big thanks, Fred. I'm a full-time student at bartending college.
Wow! I never had time for a formal education.
Well, I decided to make time, but it's not easy. Bartending college is a 4-week course.
Gee, how far along are you?
Well, let's see. This is Tuesday, the third week. Hey, I'm a junior, and I'm late for a daiquiri lecture. Why don't you join me?
Why not?
Bartending college.
You've already spent enough time on the other side of the bar to qualify for enrollment.
Bartending college.
We'll teach you everything you need to know. You'll get a starter set of bartender's jokes like...
So I says to the guy, you can stay, but the cow's gotta go.
Bartending college.
You'll learn how to roll drunks, water the liquor, and skim the cash register. And remember, as the bartender, you drink for free.
Last call
for integrity.
This is Linda Godfrey talking to you from the wild, cold woods of Wisconsin. I'm the author of Real Wolfmen, True Encounters in Modern America, and God Johnson, The Unforgiven Diary. And you are listening to After Hours AM.
And welcome back, everybody, to After Hours AM. We're happy to have you back, and it has been a heck of a show, and I love the subject matter of zombies, if I can get over my own tongue.
Say that 5 times fast.
I know, right? Jeez. Oh, yeah. I swear to God, I am a radio professional. Don't. I swear. No, before we left, we were talking to our good friend here, Steve Schulzman. He is the author of The Zombie Autopsy, as well as he is also a doctor. You know what? He is... I really enjoy talking to Steve for one, well, more than one reason. I like it because he knows his stuff. He's not just some writer that decided he's going to sit down and start aimlessly writing a zombie story. He actually has real-world training.
Well, he's a doctor.
Yeah, in the medical end of it. So he really adds that realism to it.
Yeah.
Well, Steve, welcome back to After Hours.
Thank you very much.
And before we left, we kind of were talking about how people would react when the zombie apocalypse happens. You got your book out there. You got all sorts of good stuff. Did you want to add anything, Jennifer?
Well, I was just going to say, have you ever done a brain autopsy before?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So in medical school, you do, everybody does. And then if you do electives later on in medical school, where you focus more in on that, which I did, then you spend a lot more time, cutting that brain tissue, looking at it under microscopes, looking at different areas of the brain. And more recently, when I've given talks around this book, usually they're couched in educational settings, which is really fun for, people as young as 13 or 14 and as old as, 60. And I'll order a bunch of sheep brains, which are you can easily purchase from biological supply companies that are used in like high school classes. Mm-hmm. And then we'll dissect the brain together, which is kind of cool. Sheep brains look a lot like human brains; they're just smaller.
Okay.
And it's really fun, actually.
So have you ever? Just to, I'm sorry.
Well, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just going to ask if you have ever seen anything that was kind of weird with the brain.
Yeah, so you can definitely, if you're looking at like in medical school, often the brains that you're given to dissect are from folks who have passed away, you know, having been quite old. So you'll start to see some of the degenerative brain disease, especially in the frontal lobe and the front part of the brain, where you'll see, you know, all those kind of wormy gyrations that you see in a typical picture of the brain. They're more spread out and kind of shriveled, so you can see greater spaces in between. And that's not that weird to the extent that we expect to see it, but when you compare it to a healthy brain, which you can see in pictures or in the unfortunate instances of somebody who dies, you know, well before their time, you can really see the way that the brain changes. I should say that the amazing thing about the brain, the incredible thing, is we, meaning the world culturally, hasn't really known what to do with it, except for about the last 50 years or so. We just haven't had the tools. So, you know, as far back as the Middle Ages, people could figure out what the heart did and the lungs did and the bladder and stuff like that, but nobody knew what the brain did. Aristotle thought it was for cooling the blood. So did Da Vinci. So because there's this great big weird organ with big veins or big arteries going up, the veins going down. So it was really only until much later that we started having these tools that could, you know, start to be able to say, well, this region of the brain is responsible for hunger, and this one makes me not like Justin Bieber, and this one makes me like the Grateful Dead or whatever. You know, you can sort of start to have fun that way.
Interesting.
That is really interesting. I find the brain fascinating because I've noticed one thing as I've kind of learned a few things over the years. They have not devised a computer yet that is as efficient or as fast as the human brain.
That's amazing, isn't it? I mean, it's, you know, you can design a computer that can do certain tasks as efficiently and quickly, or even more quickly than the human brain. But the iterative effect of the human brain, the ability to go from A to B to D to Q, to sort of make those intuitive leaps of discovery, that's something unique to what we can do through this sort of arborization network, the way that one neuron talks to multiple neurons, talks to even more neurons. And it is not something that happened by accident. And by that, I mean it took millions of years to evolve in this very careful way so that we can do fascinatingly complex things, which machines can't do.
Well, yeah, exactly. Like when I'm working on my computer, I get frustrated when it's not as fast as I am.
Yeah, is that neat? I mean, or even just think about like how you can't figure out a problem on your computer, and you're mad at it, and you figure out the computer's only as smart as the guy who programmed it, and so someone, you know, messed up somewhere. Then you go to sleep, and you wake up in the middle of the night, and you can fix it. So something happened in your brain. The computer didn't change at all. Something happened in your brain where ideas were consolidated, actual connections were made that didn't exist the night before. Something happened during sleep, especially, which obviously matters so much, and you can suddenly do things that machine can't do. Now, the new Spike Jonze movie really calls into question this whole issue around brains and computers and where we draw these lines, and I think that'll be an issue for this century, especially as we move forward.
I would agree, because we're starting to blur the line. Well, eventually, people will be cyborgs.
Yeah, in fact, there's a guy who has started a cyborg kind of, it's a league to make sure that people who have enhancements, this is a guy who's blind, colorblind, and so has a device that senses colors and changes them into vibrations. So if he sees red, it becomes a certain sound in his ear.
Oh, interesting.
It's a different sound. So in seeing these things, he actually goes to the museum and he sees, you know, he hears an Andy Warhol. Or he hears a, you know, Jackson Pollock or something. But it freaks people up because his antenna's sticking out of his head, so they often don't want him to come into the museum. So he kind of considers himself a cyborg. He's actually a fairly accomplished artist. And he has started this organization to do exactly what you're talking about, sort of wondering how we'll move forward as we increasingly meld with machines and retain our humanity.
Well, computers can be a very, very good thing, but at the same time, we need to work our brains, because a lot of kids, they don't work their brains these days.
Yep. People know. Well, actually, this is actually, you know, very key to the zombie storyline. As with today, because of the outreach of the Internet, which is, I think, largely a good thing to the extent that there's all this information available, but what happens is people know, you know, 10 miles wide for about an inch thick, so they can't, it's very hard for folks to go to reason through problems, and you see the same thing in zombie movies to the extent that people see zombie and they think there's only one way to handle this problem. We have to bash their head and we have to, you know, secure our parameters. We have to do all these things and then simplify, when in fact our greatest strength as humans is actually our abilities to be complex. So why would we ever sacrifice that? Why would we give that away? But we do it all the time.
We do. You know, I noticed one thing as human beings and the internet and computers and this and that, people Google things entirely too much.
I'm guilty.
Because it's there.
It's like you don't have to
And the irony of that, I wrote a fun piece, it was in the New York Times Sunday Magazine. It was really fun to write about an experience I had where I did a radio thing and we played it straight. We did it sort of War of the Worlds type thing. Mm-hmm. And people started to think that the zombies were real. And then they would Google, are zombies real, according to Harvard psychiatrist? And then Google gives you what you want to see. So Google just spits back at you exactly what you're afraid of.
Exactly. It's like looking at a medical journal about a disease and going, oh my God, I have that disease.
Well, that's like my 13-year-old daughter. She says, Mom, they have real zombies in Pittsburgh. Well, where'd you hear that from? It was on the internet. Well, if it's on the internet, it's got to be true.
Ah, yes. Right. That's where the whole, that's where
I started. I read it in a book.
That's right.
Well, it's like really not everything on the internet is true there, darling.
Well, I know I was on WebMD and I turned to you and I said, honey, I think I have the plague.
Well, that is very, very true. You know, I had a common cold and they said, you have cancer. So.
So play with this idea a little bit. What would happen if there were the sort of slow, because it wouldn't happen all at once, if there were the slow emergence of a zombie outbreak, you know, in our metropolises, and the CDC would eventually issue statements on how we could triage and know that somebody's got, you know, SARS versus somebody has a zombie bug. Mm-hmm. And then everybody would go online, right? Everybody would go online to say, what does a zombie look like? And you'd be suspecting your neighbor's old Bill across the street who's just a little scared and had too much to drink. You'd be sure he was a zombie because he wasn't walking right, and before you knew it, he'd be gone. This is the risk we run, and I say it tongue-in-cheek, but that's what these movies are about.
I knew my neighbor was a zombie. I just knew it.
Right. But, or maybe I'll just take the chance that he is because I don't want to risk that he might not be.
That's right. That's right. I saw a good zombie movie recently. Well, it's old, but I saw it again called Fido.
Oh, I love Fido. Another Canadian film.
Yeah, yeah, where they actually have zombies as pets.
Yeah, servants.
Yeah, servants. Instead of it was just funny because he eventually gets self-awareness. Fido does.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was so cool. I know Romero, he kind of played around with that with Bub in Day of the Dead. And of the self-awareness.
And Romero also plays with this idea of sort of distant memories that they might have. Like they remember what they used to be. Mm-hmm. You know, the guy at the gas station, Big Daddy, all he does is go back and forth with the gas pump because he can't kind of remember what else he used to do.
Yeah.
So this is another theme that they play with an awful lot. And they're sort of childlike, too. You know, the fireworks distract them. The wonderful thing about Fido was the way it recognize that the zombie storyline has been around long before zombies, because it was essentially a Lassie movie, right?
Yes.
Like he said.
Exactly.
Like, where's Billy? He's up in the hills and zombie fight goes, rawr, rawr, rawr. I said, he's in danger? Rawr, rawr, rawr. I'm going to go get him. This is a great movie. I loved it.
Another good one is Shaun of the Dead. I like that one.
Shaun of the Dead is a classic and a real honest-to-God zombie movie.
It is.
You know?
It is.
He's got to kill his mom. He's got to make tough decisions. He himself has to overcome his own kind of petty prejudices. And Simon Pegg is brilliant in thinking that through. It's really great.
Yeah, aim for the head, Shaun of the Dead. That's right. They're not dead unless you hit them in the head.
Right, right. That scene when they're throwing the LPs, I could watch over and over again.
Oh, I know. But,
not that one.
Yeah, no, that was a very good movie. And, you know, zombie movies, you know, you have they're like anything else. You have your good ones. You have your bad ones. In fact, I saw one recently where Abraham Lincoln was killing zombies.
I haven't seen that. I heard it was not that good. Oh, you didn't like it.
You know what? It's on. If you have Netflix, it's on there. But oh yep. my gosh, dude! You know, if you value your hour and a half, do not go see that.
You know, it's a fun one, even though it's not really a zombie movie, but they call it one. It's White Zombies. Did you ever see that?
No, I did not.
It's a Norwegian movie, and it's a bunch of medical students go off on a kind of winter retreat, and in the snow left over from World War II are a bunch of Nazi zombies who emerge from the snow. And so, again, you have this wonderful imagery of these, you know, former Nazis, now zombies, chasing these blonde-haired, blue-eyed medical students, all these Norwegian medical students, exactly the ones that they would have sort of held up and esteemed in World War II. But in this scene, they're actually chasing them and going after them, and it's very much a comedy. It's not meant to be taken seriously.
I'm going to have to look into that.
That one's sort of fun.
I'm going to have to look into that movie, because I like a good cheeky zombie movie, you know.
It is a very cheeky zombie movie.
You know, if anyone has any questions out there, I know we've been dominating this hour. Our number is 612-326-6874, 612-326-6874. If you want to weigh in, your calls are always welcome to come on in over here, and you can share with us your thoughts on the zombies. And we between me and Steve, we have a whole lot, and Jennifer over here. Jennifer actually is a zombie fanatic in the closet, and she just doesn't say it much.
Oh, no, I say it.
Okay. She is a big Walking Dead fan.
Oh, big time. Big time. I can't wait for the new season to come out. I just don't understand why they just don't do a light jog. Because not one zombie in there runs. Not one. They all walk. And all you have to do is just jog around them. Get out of breath, you know. You just kind of do a good sprint. Get out of breath. Take a little rest. They start coming. And there you go.
If I'm hearing you right, they should invest in Nikes.
Yes.
And that's all they need?
That's really
all. And cardio.
And cardio, that's right.
That's right. You know, I mean, come on.
Whoa. Or Huffies, maybe get some bicycles. They'd be fine.
They would be. You know, and they always have gas, so just keep driving.
Yeah. And I'm trying to picture the guy on the chopper motorcycle riding like a Schwinn bike with his front wheel.
That is my daughter's favorite character.
Of machismo, but he might lose some of his sex appeal.
Well,
that
he
point.
Might, but it would be a cool Huffy, though. Come on, it won't be a run of
He'd have the mountain bike with 10 speeds.
It wouldn't be the old Huffy that looked like has ram horns instead of
right. Exactly. The Walking Dead, you know, it's a juggernaut. It's Some of the episodes I've liked a ton. Some I haven't liked as much. Some of them have been some of the hardest things I've ever watched on TV. You know, just in terms of I remember that first season when they finally find that girl who's been missing for so long. Sophie, I think was her name. I mean, those were really painful but powerful scenes about how, again, we decide when we have to, you know, when we or if ever we give up on things. To me, what's fascinating about that show is its appeal. It's got appeal across huge demographic swaths and gender swaths, which I don't think they expected when they made it. It just kept making money.
Yeah, well, every week I look at the ratings, you know, for the radio station, and kind of, you know, the radio show, I kind of see what's popular. Every week when The Walking Dead's on, it's number one across the board. It beats everybody.
Yeah, it's a juggernaut. You know, it's basically funding AMC right now. And AMC's got some great, great shows. So they've been able to sort of take advantage of it. I think the messages in that show are an awful lot of fun. There's a book called The Triumph of the Walking Dead, which is a book of essays by academic types about why that show it was only about the first season, but why that show works. And so I got to write the one about the science in it. And it was really fun to sort of get together with all these different folks and think out loud about why we think this show was as popular as it was.
Why do you think?
So what I wrote, the chapter they asked me to talk about was the sort of way science, the role of science in the show. And this was, if you remember that first season, that their sort of whole goal was to get to Atlanta and get to the CDC building.
Exactly.
Because they're hearing this broadcast and they figure, there must be one person left. And essentially science fails them. You know, they get there, there's the one guy left, he basically says, look, it could be a virus, a fungus, a basically names everything that can infect anything. So it plays with our false security that we can have all of our questions answered by science. Science is really good at asking questions, as it ought to be, and it's pretty good at answering them, but it doesn't answer all of them. And in our modern world, we often kind of fall prey to this notion that every question will be immediately answered. And then when it's not answered, we feel really angry and let down, and sometimes like our rights have somehow been violated. So in the most extreme, you see that in the, you know, in that episode, the final episode, when they blow up the CDC building, when he himself does it.
Yeah.
It's, you know, so the difference of that show, of The Walking Dead, is that most zombie movies have, at least a lot of the zombie movies that I really love, have some humor involved. It's, you know, zombies on an ice skating rink in Dawn of the Dead, it's hard to beat that.
Yeah, it is. It just, is. You know, zombies on ice. It's coming next week to Duluth.
Exactly. It just doesn't get better. So you don't have any of that in The Walking Dead, and sometimes I worry that they—and I know this is potentially heretical—sometimes I worry that they take it too seriously, and then in doing so, they lose their message. I know that not everybody would agree with that.
I would agree with you though, because it's almost you almost get desensitized because they're so serious to the show. It's you know, okay, here's another weird. You almost get desensitized to the zombie. You almost get desensitized because it's so serious. It doesn't have that moment to let you breathe for a second, go, oh, right, that was kind of funny, and then it hits you with a big scare.
Right. There's no Hare Krishna zombie, as there was in Dawn of the Dead, which you kind of need, actually, because it helps you with those scenes.
It does.
But, you know, the show is still popular, and I'm still watching.
So. And I think that a lot of The Walking Dead is based on the human behavior, on how these people are reacting to the zombie apocalypse. They're turning on each other. They're killing each other. You know, they're not staying strong together. They're falling apart. You know, and I think that's huge.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I think that's huge, you know, especially... And, you know, if the zombie apocalypse actually did happen, I think it would be very interesting to see the human behavior and how fast the humans would actually turn on one another.
As somebody that studied sociology, I can tell you this. We cannot function a society without electricity. We go nuts. The lights go out. It's utter anarchy.
It's chaos.
It's total chaos. Okay. If something like this were to happen where all your infrastructure was gone, it was just every man for themselves, oh, man. Steve, it would not be pretty, would it?
No, it'd be awful. You know, this is what's so fascinating to me. The group of zombie and genre enthusiasts that actually worry me the most are the preppers who are, and this is not to say I don't like zombie preppers. I don't mean it that way, but I worry about anybody who's, I don't want people to arm up for anything, and I certainly don't want them to arm up for a zombie apocalypse. But when I talk to folks, I say, why are you doing, like, why is this something you want? They say, it'd be great. It'd be like the frontier, man. That, you know, I'd like to be simple. I'm like, have you read the journals of, like, the Oregon Trail? I mean, it was awful.
It was horrible.
Everybody died.
Yeah.
Everybody, you know, they had any teeth. It was terrible.
You ever heard of the Donner Party? I mean, come on.
Well, look what happens when you got a blackout. You got a blackout and people... they freak out. It's like, okay, light a couple candles and go from there.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But people don't stop to breathe. They automatically start panicking because we've developed so much reliability on technology and electricity and all that kind of gunk.
Well, here comes a great question from the Parex chat room. Don't mean to jump in here, but they're over there patiently waiting for me to ask this question. Why do you never see cows, horses, or cats that are zombies?
In the book I wrote, you do, because I figured it wouldn't make sense. I was trying to stay as scientifically accurate as possible. You don't see them quite as much because there are certainly viruses that have predilections for human brains over animal brains. That's why you'll have horses that get some encephalitis and not humans and vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
But there are species-to-species jumps. And if we were going to sort of imagine a naturally forming zombie infection or contagion, it would probably happen as a species-to-species jump. I mean, and this is obviously hugely conjectural.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. The zombie apocalypse is never going to happen.
So, it is not.
So all the people that have their little, you know, that have their zombie walks, though it's fun, it'll never happen.
No, we're humans. We have all sorts of ways to do ourselves in without zombies.
Well, that's right. We're really good at it. They even give awards. It's called the Darwin Awards. I mean,
right, exactly.
You know, a show I used to love is A Thousand Ways to Die. I always had to shake my head. Oh,
right, right. No, I think the, you know, the idea of part of what we're talking about in reverse is people, I think, are actually a little bit anxious over the fact about how reliant we are on the technology. So part of the appeal of any apocalyptic scenario is how would we manage? Would we be able to get by in the absence of the infrastructure that we've come to take for granted?
I think we could. I think we could.
After the chaos settles down.
You know, I think the species would survive. Look, we survived the plague.
We're mentally adapted. I mean, I actually think we could, too. I sort of have a Pollyannish view of this. I think that we would figure out a way to get along. I think you're right. I think there would probably be some initial chaos. And then I'm fairly confident that people would, you know, we had this huge snowstorm recently in my little suburban town here outside Boston. And suddenly everybody was out shoveling everybody else's walk. And I hadn't seen that in years. But
yeah, exactly.
People came out and helped each other.
Another great question coming from to us from Pair X is, what about real Haitian zombies? Gray Davis seems to think it was possible.
Yeah. Yeah, so you're talking about the Haitian zombies?
Yeah.
Did I hear that right?
Yes.
Yeah, Haitian. That's a really neat topic. So it was for a long time. It still might be a capital crime in Haiti to turn somebody into a zombie. The notion there is that you've got these dark priests who practice, you know, part of the voodoo religion, and as a means of extracting some kind of revenge for people who have somehow transgressed in the society, done something that they ought not to have done, they induce in them a state that looks close to death using the tetrodotoxin, the pufferfish toxin.
Okay.
So those folks look like they're dead, and then they get buried because they're outside of any place where they have the technology to see that they're in fact not dead. And then when they're brought back to, you know, they're unburied and brought back up, the same priest administers to them various alkaloids, things that are found on like the skin of the New World toad is its one source.
Okay.
And that keeps them in this kind of state of delirium and confusion, and they kind of become slaves. In that way.
There was a movie based on that, Serpent in the Rainbow, am I correct?
Yep, with Bill Pullman, I think, based on the way Davis, who was an ethnobiologist, is an ethnobiologist, on his first estate and his novel. So it's a real phenomena, the idea, you know, like it's out there. How prevalent it is I think, way up for grabs, and that has been somewhat controversial. Those zombies, in those zombie movies, the movies that are about those zombies, nobody's afraid of zombies. They're afraid of becoming zombies.
Mm-hmm.
So, there's nothing to be afraid of a zombie that you see in the field in those movies. That zombie's not going to do anything. It's what you're afraid of is that you're going to be turned into a zombie by one of the dark priests.
Yeah, yeah. I'm more geared toward the creeping death zombie.
Yeah. I think that's a more fun kind of mentality because they just never quit.
Yeah.
You know, they might only be walking half a mile an hour, but they're never going to stop.
That's right. It's like the cold weather outside. You can fight it all you want to, but you can't win.
It always reminds me most of that skunk in the old Bugs Bunny cartoons that was always chasing the cat. I think it was Pepe Le Pew.
Pepe Le Pew.
He's never going to stop.
No.
He's always going to keep going.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, Steve, we have about a minute left. I'd like you to plug everything you got coming up, what you got going, where people can find you, and all that kind of good stuff.
The next thing on the agenda is a sequel to the zombie novel, which I feel kind of like, you know, my full-time job is a doctor, but I feel like a real writer, and that my agent has called me and said, please write the sequel. So I'm working on that. The script, like I said, George finished that. The agents, our agents have that. It's bouncing around Hollywood now, and hopefully we'll hear soon about, you know, making that into a movie. And then just a bunch of short stories and projects that I'm working on that are sort of in the horror genre, but not necessarily zombie-based. I have a website, thezombieautopsy.com. And, you can always check out what I'm up to there.
Wow.
Perfect.
That's going to be cool. We're going to definitely have you back again.
It would be my pleasure.
We're going to have you back again when all the stuff drops, or even if it's not dropping, we'll just have you back again to say, hey, Steve, how you doing?
It would be awesome.
Well, everybody, for Jennifer Mattson and myself, Joel Sturgis, we want to tell you good night and stay warm, love each other, all that kind of good stuff. Have a great week. And again, I'd like to thank our guest, Steve Scholzman. Did I do it right? No, I didn't do it right, did I? What's your last name?
Fine.
Okay. I had it in the background.
The only one who cares is my mother. It's fine.
Well, we'd like to thank him again for coming on the show. And everybody, see you next week. We have a lot of cool things coming up in the weeks to come, but you'll find that out. Just visit us on the Facebook page. Like us over there at afterhoursam.com, or actually at the Facebook page. I know it's new, so I'm still kind of getting used to the whole like us over a Facebook thing. I mean, anyhow, I digress. We are out of here, guys. Take care.
Have a good night.
Thank you for listening to this edition of After Hours AM. Now stick around for tours through time only on the Para-X Radio Network.